Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. It's another fan club. It's another fan club. Fan club. Fan club. Fan club. Fan club. It's another fan club. That's the new
theme.
Yeah, it's a new theme. I have joined the Zoom call with 1 minute to spare, 45 seconds, really, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find the link, and I found it. And now I'm here. And don't worry, guys, it's going ahead.
I didn't realise that's what... I saw Natalie was panicking about something, but I didn't have my phone on to see that that's what the issue was, because I could have just done that. Would have been fine.
I just scrolled down my emails. I do find it weird when you have a Zoom. I've got a Zoom meeting on Monday, mm-hmm. and the people that have organised the Zoom meeting have sent me the link to it yesterday, Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, it's too early, isn't it?
And you just think, do you think that I haven't got emails? Do you think that I'm... Just send it 10 minutes before the fucking meeting.
Yeah, have it there.
I'm not having a go at the FUBAR lot. I'm just saying that 6 days in advance to be invited to a Zoom meeting is too much. I'm going to forget there's a meeting. I'm definitely going to. So just 10 minutes before, and then I'll go, right, I've got to be there. Brilliant. I can do it.
Well, the night before. Oh, yeah.
6 days in advance. It's just like, fucking the amount of stuff I'm buying on Amazon for Christmas at the moment. It's just like, you get an email every time you order it. Then when they say, yeah, we're going to give it to you. And then they go, yeah, we're sending it. And then they go, yeah, it's on its way. And then they go, it's delivered. And then the building I'm in, send me another. Like, that's like five emails per purchase. It's like, fucking, well, you think that, honestly, this time of year, it's my busiest time of year. I'm Santa Claus. Anyway, my name's Nick.
My name is Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to another five-star family fun-size fan club. I struggled with that at first, and now, you know, 100 episodes later, I can really nail five-star family fun-size fan club. It's easy now.
Five-star family fun-size fan club. It is.
It's easy. Rolls off the tongue, which is lucky, because that's where I put it. First rule of fan club.
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends about fan club. Why not? Hey, tell you what, we've all had a tough year. Money's a bit tight. The best Christmas gift that you can give is just maybe jot it down on a piece of paper and give it to someone and say, hey, tune into fan club. That's my little tip. It's like Blue Peter in a way, isn't it?
There's probably like 150 hours of content to get through.
Are you joking?
I don't know. Would that be right? How many shows? We do 2 hours a week.
The first 6 months... was 1 hour, so that's 60 hours. And then we did 2 hours for 2 years.
Oh, yeah. We've got tons.
We've got, like, over 500 hours of content. Fucking hell.
I mean, content's the right word, really, isn't it?
It's filler.
Filler.
What I would say, it certainly got me through a lot of lockdown. What I would say is somebody said the other day, I listened to the latest fan club... And I listened to the first fan club, and your opinions on Star Wars haven't changed. It's almost like you're on repeat. And what I would say is, yeah, my opinions on Star Wars haven't changed. Yeah, I would agree with that.
But we were making opinions don't really change, though, do they?
We were making a very different point. I think we were talking about mythology last week, which did encompass Star Wars chat, but. Mm-hmm. Really, we weren't talking about that the first time. We were just talking about Star Wars. Mm-hmm. So I think what you have to realise is if someone has a certain interest, mentioning something twice over a 2.5 year period, isn't that fucking weird? So don't try and edit me. All I can suggest is if you don't like the fucking content of the fucking radio show / podcast, start your own fucking podcast. Then you see how fucking easy it is. Like we've just said, over 500 hours of fucking content. So have like a half hour that overlaps. I mean, it's not like we mention the same thing every week.
Have you seen
any John Carpenter this week? Oh my God. I did watch Big Trouble in Little China again.
There we go. How was it, Pierre?
It's just amazing. It gets better every time I watch it.
I love it.
I think
Hayley Campbell, one-time fan club presenter, one-time fan club guest, doesn't like the film. I find it baffling. Hates it.
I think that maybe she hasn't seen it that often. I also think that I used to watch it as an action film, mm-hmm. and I find it lacking. But if you watch it purely as a comedy, you go, it's brilliant. Also, the other thing I noticed, which is probably documented somewhere, but I sort of worked it out for myself, was that famously, Kurt Russell does a Clint Eastwood impression in Escape from New York. So basically, rather than act, he does a bad Clint Eastwood impression for Escape from New York and Escape from LA, right? And then when you watch Big Trouble in Little China, you realise he's just doing a bad John Wayne impression.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, well, Big Trouble in Little China, when it was first invented, when it was first thought of, was originally meant to be a Western. And it was about, you know, Chinese immigrants and stranger in town turning up. Like, you can see it, right?
It's absolutely.
Big Trouble in Little China, the Pork Chop Express is basically is his horse. It gets stolen. He starts off gambling. He's got a horse saddle over his shoulder, and he wears sort of like a duster. And it's kind of like that. It was originally a Western, and then they didn't have enough budget to do sort of like a period film, so they updated it. And there's still sort of like a Western in its DNA.
Yeah, totally. As soon as you say it, you can picture it, go, oh, yeah, I know exactly what that'd be like.
So to do a John Wayne impression, it's kind of like, right, so he's done. he's done Clint Eastwood.
As a choice, though, I don't mind that at all. I mean, I know you don't mind it either. But, like, it's like, as a performances go, I quite like that thing where someone's gone, basically, you want this, don't you? And there's other examples of that. I think Gangs in New York, Daniel Day-Lewis is basically going, Robert De Niro didn't want to do it. How about I do a Robert De Niro impression for 3 hours? And Martin Scorsese goes, cheers, mate. That's what I want. That's basically what I want. What other things are like that where someone's just doing an impression of, Ghost Rider, the Nicolas Cage film, where he's basically doing an Elvis impression. And you go, yeah, that character makes sense as like Evel Knievel Elvis. It's just like, it makes it more fun. And the character on the page is boring. So Nicolas Cage brings all this like, well, I'll just create a proper character then and make it this sort of caricature Elvis, Evel Knievel, and then you go, oh, it's more fun now.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Well, also because it's filtered through someone else. It's not the first, you just think it's Kurt Russell doing a character.
Mm.
And then when you go, oh, he's actually doing an impression of someone.
Mm.
And he's done it for the entire film. And also the character is he's not like an anti-hero in the sense that he's an anti-hero because he's a shit hero. Like, he doesn't achieve hardly a single... He has one heroic moment, which is a fluke. And everything else is sort of like he's late to the fights. He misses out on the fights altogether. He gets stuck underneath a heavy guard. He shoots rocks and they hit him in the head and he's unconscious for an entire battle. It's like... I love it. And I think that... I think that's what I kind of, like, didn't appreciate. I mean, I've seen it... I saw it once at the beginning of the year and it's got to the point this year where I've gone... It's come round again on my cycle of things that I want to watch. What I do is I watch it as a perfect double bill, which is... you watch Big Trouble in Little China and then you watch Tango and Cash. And Big Trouble in Little China, he's amazing in. And Tango and Cash, he's basically doing the same thing, but it's incredibly unlikable. That film is so... It's so enjoyable, but it's so rubbish. I just love it. But I like it. I don't even know if I like it ironically. Technically, I hate it. But I just sort of like revel in all of the poor decisions. Like, not one piece of, you know, you're watching a film that is starring the Oscar winning screenwriter Sylvester Stallone, and not one piece of dialogue lands for 2 hours. It's like, it's so.
Did you write that as well?
Say again?
Did you write that one as well?
No, he didn't write it. But he's on set. And he's learning the lines and he's saying it. it's like Tango and Cash is a film that is entirely fueled on cocaine. It's kind of like just nothing really works. They've stolen so much from so many other films, and you kind of, it's even miscast. It's just like, just swap them over.
I think we said this before. I remember
you said it. I think we almost said it like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, maybe. And we said this, that I remember at the time feeling like, wow, Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell in the same film.
Yeah, we have definitely
seen this. Okay. All right, never mind.
Oh, no, this is like, it's almost Christmas. This is our greatest hits roundup of, it's our lap of honour.
I couldn't believe, because it was like, wow, both in the same film. And I never, Kurt Russell is such a big presence of my film watching all my life since I was a kid, that I didn't think that Kurt Russell was ever like a B-movie star. I thought he was like the idea. I thought they were like titans of cinema in the same film. Like, wow, how can you get them both in the same film? That's amazing. Not thinking at all that Sylvester Stallone was a far bigger star than Kurt Russell was.
Yeah, but when we were young, we grew up in video shops. Mm. So that is like the ultimate leveler, you know. Yeah. And then also, you know, Sylvester Stallone, by that point, was the king of the American box office, even more than Arnold Schwarzenegger, really. Mm. Like 1985 was Rambo 2 and then Cobra, and Cobra wasn't a big hit, which was a big surprise for everyone. But, oh no, that was like 1986. But he was still doing Rocky films. I think Rocky 4 was out as well. So, like, Sylvester Stallone was absolutely huge, by which point Schwarzenegger had done Commando in 85, Terminator in 84, Raw Deal in 86, and then Predator in 86 or 87. And Predator was like the one that really sort of like established him as kind of like, oh no, this guy. He was a bad guy in Terminator. And it was popular, but it was kind of like Predator was the one that really sort of like established him. And people forget, like, Twins was a genuine bona fide blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
One of the, especially because it was a PG.
Exactly.
So he had all these kids that idolized him, and then finally they could see the film that he was in. So it was like a huge family film. And, you know, every two tickets that you were buying for a date turned into 4 to 5 tickets because you were taking your family. Because all the lucky people that got dragged along to Arnold Schwarzenegger films in the 80s on a date. But do you know what I mean? It was like a Friday night event. And then Twins was just like, nah, this is like this huge, before Home Alone, before Batman, it was just massive.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, it was because all the kids watched his films on video were suddenly allowed to see Schwarzenegger film in the cinema.
But also, it was kind of like, I sort of discount Twins and all of his comedies. It's kind of like, yeah, that's kind of like the also-rans. But they actually largely contribute to his box office success.
Mm.
Like Kindergarten Cop, which I've seen again in lockdown, that's great. Like, I've always hated it. And then I watched it, and you just go, no, it's brilliant. For what it is, it's done really, really well. And there's sort of like a level of violence to it where it's kind of like, oh my God, it's kind of edgy. But yeah, so I did.
It's 12 Kindergarten Cop over here.
Yeah, it would have been. Or maybe it was a 15.
I remember seeing it in cinema. Can't remember
how old. I think it might have been a 15. It's pretty violent, you know. The guy gets shot and bitten by a ferret. Have you seen Kindergarten Cop 2?
No, is that with Dolph Lundgren?
Yeah.
Never seen it.
I think I'm probably going to watch it over Christmas. I don't know where to find it. But I will find it and I will watch it. And I will, I don't know. I don't know if I'll enjoy it. I was going to say, and I will enjoy it, but I don't know if I will. Have you ever seen Dark Angel?
No, I haven't actually, no. That was like meant to be his comeback, wasn't it? But it didn't really take.
Was it a comeback? I think it was sort of like, it was either late 80s or early 90s. It was Dolph Lundgren doing an action horror movie. And I've never seen it, but I saw, and I've never thought about it. I haven't seen a lot of Dolph Lundgren, even though we've met the man.
Yeah, it's funny actually when you think about it, because he was always a big, massive star, but I guess entirely from Rocky IV. in your head. Like, what a huge star. But yeah, that's all he did.
I don't think he was always a massive star. I don't think
it wasn't. It was a bit. Well, he was a presence. He felt like a real, like, you know, every kid knew who Dolph Lundgren was.
I think that he would, well, because of Rocky IV, yeah, and then Masters of the Universe.
Mm.
But Masters of the Universe kind of like was the one that went like, actually, he's not a star.
Yeah. Punisher as well, I watched as a kid. That was an 18. I guess that's just by chance, isn't it? That's and I guess because I read comics, it was a kind of, oh, I want to see the Punisher film.
It's not great, is it?
No.
Like, there's huge action sequences that are basically filmed in a hotel lobby and it's all brightly lit. And it's there's like loads of kind of atmosphere when he's in the sewers. But as soon as he comes out above ground, you know, he's sort of like operating in sheer daylight. Did you ever see Big Trouble, Showdown in Little Tokyo?
No.
That's him and Brandon Lee. You imagine it was, I think it's something like 82 minutes long. So you imagine it was like cut right down for something. But it's, they've got, it's Dolph Lundgren and Brandon Lee, and then they've thrown in Tia Carrera to sort of like make it, you know, heterosexual. But it is the most, like deliberately so, it is kind of like one of the most homoerotic action movies ever made. It's so good. Dolph Lundgren is, he is capable of turning in some pretty poor performances. But having said that, he is also capable of turning in some pretty great performances. And he's really good. He's terrible in Masters of the Universe, but he was learning English.
Mm.
He was great in Rocky IV, but he's basically a prop. But when you see stuff like Showdown in Little Tokyo, you realise that, you know, he was great. And anyway, I saw these clips from Dark Angel, and it looked like, I think maybe I'll have a Dolph Lundgren season where I go out and watch Red Scorpion, like all the ones that, you know, I've sort of missed. What's the word? Joshua Tree. Is it called Joshua Tree? Is that an action? It's an action movie.
What do you mean?
It's kind of like I think he's mainly known for Rocky IV, Masters of the Universe, and then being in the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, Universal Soldier, where they were kind of pitted head-to-head, but really it was kind of like Jean-Claude Van Damme was so big, and Dolph Lundgren was very much like the Kurt Russell to his Stallone, you know?
Exactly. Very good comparison. I think at the time, again, it felt like it was, to me, almost like it felt like a power play for Jean-Claude Van Damme, like, wow, he's really made it if he can be top billing against Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. And it's a Roland Emmerich film.
Yeah.
It's like, was it his first film or his second film? I think he made one about time travel and ghosts or something, a kid's film. Universal Soldier. And then a couple of years later, he made Stargate, Independence Day, and then like all of the disaster movies. But like Roland Emmerich's first kind of like really big hit. I'm not really, I don't know, haven't seen loads of Jean-Claude Van Damme. My favourite Jean-Claude Van Damme film is JCVD.
Never seen that either.
You've not seen JCVD? Watch JCVD. It's brilliant. It sort of doesn't quite live up to its premise, which is Die Hard in a post office, right? But basically, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme in Belgium, and he's got to go to a post office to pay his kids alimony because he's playing Jean-Claude Van Damme. He's playing himself. He's a deadbeat dad who's like failed. You know, he's straight to video. He knows that he's kind of like not lived up to. He's frittered away his talents, and now he's got to pay alimony in a post office. And then it gets overrun by robbers, and then it's Jean-Claude Van Damme having kind of an existential crisis in a post office where he does like monologues directly to the camera. There's this amazing kind of like, I'm going to say 5 minutes, but I'm imagining it's slightly shorter. There's this amazing 5 minute action sequence at the beginning where they do everything in one shot, where he basically goes around an entire film set to this amazing music, and he's just beating the shit out of everyone all in one shot. It's great because he's talking in Flemish, and he's great And then you realise that everything clunky about him is this language barrier.
Yes, yeah.
But I like Nowhere to Run. I liked Hard Target.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of like Time Cop. So there's kind of like...
The big one at my school was Bloodsport, which was big because you kick someone's leg and their bone comes out. That was the big, we've got to see that.
I've not seen Legionnaire. I've not seen... Is Lionheart Bloodsport or is that another film?
Oh, I don't know.
I've not seen Cyborg. Cyborg, famously, was the sequel to Masters of the Universe. Canon Films were making a sequel to Masters of the Universe. Basically, what happened was Canon Films had the rights to... Warner Brothers made all of the Superman films up to the third one. And then Canon bought the rights to Superman 4, right? Christopher Reeve didn't want to do it. So they said, hey, what if you wrote it? What if you wrote the storyline to it? So Christopher Reeve said, right, I'm really interested in the Cold War and nuclear armament. And I think maybe we could do something that's like anti-nuclear weapons. So Christopher Reeve wrote this sort of like pacifist Superman film, which is, like, you know, worthy. And rather than put all of their money into Superman and or all of their money into Masters of the Universe, Canon Films basically said, right, we also have the rights to Spider-Man. So if we really, really... if we make two mid-budget huge successes, then we can make James Cameron's Spider-Man. I think it was James Cameron's Spider-Man. Because James Cameron was attached to it for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And so they made... so they cut all the budget for Masters of the Universe and they cut all the budget for Superman 4 and they made them both on the cheap, thinking that they're just going to be huge hits. And then we'll make Spider-Man and then we'll like put our foot in the door. And like, at that time, like Cobra with Stallone, they didn't quite have the budget to do Cobra, so they did a co-production with Warner Brothers and then, you know... Cobra became a much bigger kind of budget movie than Canon were kind of used to. but again, like Cobra was like a 2-hour film that got chopped down to an hour and a half. And it was meant to be a lot more kind of like edgy. But I don't understand how it could have been edgy. Because he eats pizza with a pair of scissors. You know, it's like he cuts the crust off with some scissors and just eats the pizza tips. And it's meant to be like really macho. And you go, this is absolutely pathetic. it's like your teeth don't work. So Masters of the Universe and Superman 4 were both massive flops. And then it basically meant that they were too cheap. Canon were too cheap to pay for the rights or renew the rights to Masters of the Universe. But because they were expecting it to be a big hit, they'd already built most of the set and the costumes. And so rather than get rid of it all, they just rewrote it as Cyborg and made a Jean-Claude Van Damme film, which was a really big hit for Jean-Claude Van Damme, which ended up kind of like cementing him as like a VHS superstar. And then through that, he kind of like started making stuff like Double Impact, Universal Soldier. And then through that, Sam Raimi somehow got involved with him. And Sam Raimi produced Hard Target with John Woo and Time Cop, like out of nowhere. And then I guess Renaissance Pictures, which is Sam Raimi, they produced the Time Cop TV series, which ended up having Bruce Campbell in an episode. But I don't know the story behind Sam Raimi in the early 90s. He's done all the Evil Deads. He's done Darkman. He's waiting to do A Simple Plan. Did he do anything in between those films?
No.
Did he not do anything between Darkman and Simple Plan?
Hang on.
This is just two people thinking.
Oh, Army of Darkness.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, right. So, yeah, well, I don't... Fuck me. Jesus. Yeah, so he did Darkman, Army of Darkness. But then he... Can you get his CV up for us, please? Sam Raimi. Yeah, and so in between, like, I guess around the same time he was doing Army of Darkness, no, just before Army of Darkness, he did, Hard Target. Well, actually, Army of Darkness was 92, so Hard Target was 91, I think. Oh, let's have a look. Right, okay. So, so he did Evil Dead, Crime Wave, Evil Dead 2. Crime Wave was a massive flop, but it should have starred Bruce Campbell. Crime Wave has got like three really great jokes in it, which are timeless jokes, which are worth sitting through the film for, but it's an incredibly irritating film to watch. But it's got like three or maybe four really amazing moments in it that are worth it. Evil Dead 2, Easy Wheels.
Actually, he wrote that by looking at it, but didn't direct it. Dark Man, he directed.
The Nut House, A Dark Man. The Nut House, didn't direct. Right. Army of Darkness, yes, directed. Hudsucker Proxy, he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Quick and the Dead. Of course. That was like his last like proper genre Sam Raimi type film. And then he did Simple Plan, where he was kind of doing a slightly Sam Raimi Coen Brothers, which is funny because at the time everyone was like, Sam Raimi's basically doing Fargo. But in actual fact, when you watch Raising Arizona, it's the Coen brothers that are basically doing Evil Dead as a romantic comedy, which is bonkers. But, and obviously, Joel Coen was the sound editor on Evil Dead. So they all grew up together. And then they did, you know, we've said this before, but Crime Wave is set in Hudsucker Prison. And then later on, Sam Raimi writes the Hudsucker Proxy, for the Coen brothers, or with the Coen brothers, which again has Bruce Campbell in it. So there was this period in between, like the early 90s, when he was making Dark Man, Army of Darkness, Quick and the Dead, that he produced these two huge Jean-Claude Van Damme movies and basically was responsible for bringing John Woo over to America for his like 8-year grace period before people sent him back.
Yeah, I mean, that's a shame. It's, I guess because in Hong Kong he was making kind of films that over here all your kind of film fans were kind of going nuts over, and I guess in Hollywood, and they bring him over and they put him on material that's probably not terribly suited to him, really.
I don't know if it wasn't suited to him, but I think that he has a bag of tricks. And by the time he came over to Hollywood, he was basically pastiching himself.
Mm.
So you have the doves and the slow motion and the double-handed gunplay. And all of the action scenes are like, by the time you get to Mission Impossible 2, it's ridiculous. Mission Impossible 2 steals jokes from Dark Man because it's all about sort of like wearing masks and stuff. So there's like there's a sequence in Dark Man, in Mission Impossible 2, that is a direct lift from Dark Man. It's kind of like, by the time he did Mission Impossible 2, it's kind of like, I really love Broken Arrow. I really love Hard Target. What else did he do? Face Off. I sort of like tapped
Wind
out.
Wind Talkers.
What was that one?
Wind Talkers.
No. I have seen it, but no. That was it. It was kind of like in the 90s, you had, you had The Rock, Con Air, Broken Arrow, and then the culmination of all of that hard work from everyone, Face Off. And Face Off, I think, really suffers today because of all of the blatant stunt work, where you can just see two guys that aren't John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, like clear as day in the middle of most shots, just water skiing and having a fight on a boat. And you go, you haven't even attempted to hide their faces. These are just stunt guys.
I would say even at the time, though, like I was in the, like you say, it felt like it was the culmination of all those movies. But at the time, I was really disappointed in Face Off and I was so excited for it. But when it came out, I was like a bit like, it's fine.
I just thought it was funny that they stole one of their big plot devices from an episode of Red Dwarf 4. You know, is it Red Dwarf 4 or Red Dwarf 3 when they're in the prison and they've got those cyber boots and they're magnetized to the floor? And you kind of like go, yeah, like Red Dwarf, right? It's crazy. I don't know. Anyway, I liked Face Off at the time. I thought it was really cool. But John Travolta was the coolest. It might be hard for anyone to really comprehend. if you're younger than 25, but there was a period in the 90s where John Travolta was the absolute coolest guy on the entire planet for maybe the third time in his career.
He was the biggest movie star and was getting paid $20 million a movie.
Yeah. He was so cool, though. Well, he did Pulp Fiction. All of a sudden, he was cool. Because before Pulp Fiction, he was making Look Who's Talking Now, which is a talking dog movie. It was, you know, it's kind of, his career, yeah. I've got like, I don't know. There's all the Scientology stuff, but he was really good in American Crime Story. I really want to see Moose. Is it called Moose?
Is that the fan one?
Is it called Fanatic? He plays a character called Moose, directed by Ted Durst from Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, that's right. The Fred Durst directs it, doesn't he? And I think, doesn't it start with someone saying, oh, I'm just listening to this Limp Bizkit album. It's really cool.
Okay, we got. How do we wrap this chat up? What were we talking about?
What was our point?
Dolph Lundgren.
Django Cash is rubbish. Yeah.
Django Cash is rubbish, but if you've not seen it, it's also amazing. Like, they get. I'm going to say, I've said it in almost every episode of Fan Club, but I cannot comprehend this. It was made 1 year after Die Hard. They steal a line from Die Hard and they get it wrong. In Die Hard, Bruce Willis says, where did you learn? Who taught you how to drive? Stevie Wonder? And in Tango Cash, Kurt Russell goes, where did you learn to drive? Stevie Wonder? It's amazing. It's in the film. It's in the film. He gets it wrong. He says it. And they were all so off their faces. I don't know if Kurt Russell was, but I get the impression Sylvester Stallone was so off his face on coke on that film. His fucking... They were just, oh, my God, it's absolutely amazing. Anyway, I love All Em Lot. It's my childhood, and I'll cry if I want to. I love them. And, And our guest last week, Simon West, directed all of them in one film. And it was fucking hard getting him to talk about it, but he did in the end. We're going to play a song now, and then we'll talk some more in however long it is.
You will.
Somebody saw you at the station. You had your suitcase in your hand. You didn't give no information. You walked off with another man. I'm always standing in the shadows, baby. You give yourself away. And you take them home into your bedroom. Oh, you had another busy day. Huh. I tried to look the other way and fake it. You pushed me to the limit. I can't take. Someday they'll put me in a squad car. Someday they'll throw away the key. But till that day I'll be a mad dog. Cause that's what you taught me to be. You looked into the eyes of me. Just another bullet in the
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! So what have you been a fan of? We just news just in. Kurt Russell replaced Patrick Swayze in Tango and Cash. Patrick Swayze went off to do Roadhouse, which is basically if you like Dirty Dancing, but you thought there wasn't enough fighting in it, then that's the movie for you. It's basically got the same soundtrack, but it's got like Patrick Swayze kicking the shit
Dirty
out.
Dirty Dancing for boys.
Yeah, it's Roadhouse. I love Dirty Dancing. Dirty Dancing is like one of my all-time favourite films. And Roadhouse, in terms of Patrick Swayze films, is kind of like maybe a close second, I think. Roadhouse is great, but it's not as good as Dirty Dancing, but it's got a lot of the same, like there was a real 50s fetishism in the 80s, and Roadhouse is just all 50s music, or 50s, 60s. Oh, it's great. Anyway, he went off to do that and Kurt Russell came in. But you can tell because Kurt Russell basically steals Patrick Swayze's hair.
Yes, yeah, I can see that. I thought what I'd do is, because we've been locked down, I saw an opportunity in Sainsbury's the other day. I saw a new drink available and I thought we could do what we used to do. So I bought it and it's a new drink and it's the limited edition cinnamon Coca-Cola for Christmas.
Right. So I went into my local shop and I couldn't find cinnamon Coca-Cola because I didn't pay. But what I did find was I found an American Apple Fanta.
Okay.
And I also found this other soft drink called Genuine Faygo, which is an American can size, slightly bigger.
Oh, yeah.
It's 355 rather than 330 millilitres. And this flavour is called Rock and Rye. Delicious Rock and Rye Faygo. Okay. So I guess what? You'll open yours, I'll open mine, and we'll review them for you live on air. Not live, pre-recorded.
Okay, so I guess this is for Christmas, the cinnamon. Smell. Oh, yeah. I think I've been reminded that I don't really like cinnamon.
Right.
So it smells like, you know, dentine chewing gum.
Right. There he is. He's drinking it. I can see him. Over Zoom.
Do you know what? If anything, the cinnamon is so low in the... I think they've done it, realised it's disgusting, and then really toned down the cinnamon so you can barely taste it.
I mean, you say that, but, I mean, their Diet Coke with cherry doesn't taste like Diet Cherry Coke. Like, Cherry Coke is one of the nicest drinks on the planet, and their Diet Coke with cherry is one of the most disgusting things I've ever drank.
It's fine, actually.
Yeah?
Disappointing.
Going to give this Apple Tango a swig.
Mm-hmm. He's drinking it. He's going for it. Oh, he's had a few gulps.
Yeah. For those of you out there that feel like apple ties doesn't really punch you in the mouth like it should, what can I say?
It's strong apple-y taste.
Apple Fanta. Oh, my God, that is a delicious drink.
Very sweet.
If I'm not drinking at the moment. Do you know what? I think back, and most years I don't drink during December until Christmas. Because that means that your first drink on Christmas morning, you know, you invite the rest of the day off. But I reckon Apple Fanta would taste absolutely amazing with gin, with ice. Lovely. Yeah, great. Well,
That's our segment.
Have you seen anything this week?
I'll tell you, a big franchise that I watched for the first time, although I've only seen the first two movies, I saw Jumanji, 1995. Never seen
it. That's right. Joe Johnson.
And I like Joe Johnson, Johnston's films. So I wanted to see Jumanji. And
Not that much.
No, but I think it was on Netflix. I watched it.
It's taken you 26 years to see it.
Yeah, it's taken me 26 years to see it. And I was, do you know what? I was never really interested. Then I kind of just had a moment of weakness where I went, yeah, go on, do a Jumanji. And it felt kind of, the kind of thing I was sort of in the mood for, a bit kind of mindless. And I'd say the whole film is a bit like, I thought it was a really good screenplay and I thought it all fit together well, but I didn't care. And I thought, it's just because I'm older and it's like a kid's film. But then by the end, it really charmed me. And almost like, and when I say by the end, I mean literally the last 5 minutes of the film I found really charming and it made the whole film better. And at the end of it, it sort of ends with this thing where you go, oh, I really like that. And I don't think I was enjoying watching it, but the last sort of 5 or 10 minutes really, really sort of saved it for me.
I remember when the trailers came out because it was it 94, 95?
95.
So I remember when the trailers came out, it was a couple of years after Jurassic Park, and then this was the new big special effect thing. Mm-hmm. And the special effects looked absolutely incredible in the trailers. And it's one of those things where they've aged really badly. Mm-hmm. But I like the film in terms of, I'm not a massive Robin Williams fan. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of his films, they veer between watching a man improvise out of context of the script. And then when the script kicks in, they're overly sentimental. And I just find they veer so far. I think Jumanji walks that line better than most of them.
Agreed.
Plus, it's got David Alan Grier in, who is brilliant. Uh-huh. And it's got Bonnie Hunt in,
yes,
who is also sort of like, yeah, she's basically, she's great. She was like, she's a comedian, she's a writer, she's directed stuff. She's had several TV shows. I know this because I have had quite a heavy week in terms of stuff that I've been forced to watch against my will. My girlfriend suffers from horrific periods. And sometimes she just doesn't want to watch a Martin Scorsese film. We ended up watching Father of the Bride. I love Steve Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Steve Martin up to a point and then his films. I think maybe I do like Father of the Bride.
I was going to say, I would say that's almost on the cusp for me. I wouldn't say it's beyond the pale by any means.
I like it, but then I also feel like, well, I'll tell you what I've seen this week.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Father of the Bride. Father of the Bride Part 2.
Okay.
Cheaper by the Dozen.
Yeah, is it?
Cheaper by the Dozen 2.
Cheaper by the Dozen, I remember seeing the trailer for that, and that has a joke in it where Steve Martin's wife says, oh, what's it like having 12 kids? And she said, oh, it's fine. After the fourth one, they just start walking out. And you go, that's a strong joke for a PG.
Yeah, and it feels sort of like, that's Bonnie Hunt. So Bonnie Hunt it's just that Steve Martin at that time, he was a dedicated comedian. I don't think he didn't have kids, but he got kind of like this, he got into this groove of like basically after Parenthood of playing kind of like the comedy dad. I think he's so good in Parenthood. And then Planes, Trains and Automobiles, I watched last night. So I had to. It was a palate cleanser. I'd sort of forgotten what I liked about him. So Father of the Bride is great. Mm-hmm. Father of the Bride 2 is weird, where basically they've gone...
I think I've seen it. I can't remember anything about it.
They've gone, everyone likes Martin Short from Father of the Bride. So let's make him basically, in the second half of the film, the lead. So Martin Short is now the main character in Father of the Bride Part 2.
So he's neither the father nor the bride. He's a wedding arranger.
And it's about, like, the daughter becoming pregnant and then Diane Keaton becomes pregnant. And then it's kind of like... but they all keep referring to themselves as the father of the bride and the mother of the bride. And it's kind of like, why? Well, I don't know anyone. I don't know anyone.
After they're married.
Years and years after their kids get married, keep referring to themselves as the father of the bride, other than to just make it relevant to the title of the film. Father of the Bride 2, it's fucking insane. Like,
it's a remake as well, isn't it? The second one is also a remake.
Father's Little Dividend.
Yeah.
So Spencer Tracy was in Father of the Bride, and then they made a sequel to that called Father's Little Dividend, and it's kind of like a remake of that. It's weird because the first one is kind of like got one foot in reality. The second one has like these surreal moments where everything is amped up to 11, right? So everything that was kind of like quite funny and sweet about the first film is just ratcheted up. Like Brian McKenzie's parents, in the first one, he was a bit emotional. In this one, he's basically getting off with a dog because he's so emotional about leaving it behind when he's going on holiday. And everyone's like looking at him like he's the most disgusting piece of shit on the planet. And he's got his tongue in a dog's mouth. And you're kind of like going, yeah, it's disgusting. I'm pretty sure there were three dogs in the first one. There's only two dogs in the second film. But they're kind of like, there's no reference to one of them being put down or anything. So I guess they're just imagining... You're not meant to see them back to back. There's a moment in it where Diane Keaton and... So this was a big deal, having Steve Martin and Diane Keaton in a film together. Mm-hmm. You've got Annie Hall and The Jerk, and they're playing the parents of, you know, 15 years later, 12 years later, after their big first smashes, they're now kind of like the parents of... You're growing old with them, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's a bit when they're kissing in the second film, just before they have sex and Steve Martin impregnates Diane Keaton. And there's some foreboding lightning that happens, like it's a horror film. And it's kind of like, okay. There's a bit when they're looking at their house and how beautiful their house is, and then a rainbow shines over it. And it's kind of like, okay. So it's not... So we're having like moments of surrealism, right? It's like... Okay, and then Eugene Levy shows up playing a completely different character to what you played in the first film, which is basically a highly offensive Arabic portrayal of a dirty foreigner who's going to buy their childhood house and then basically knock it down and build flats, right? And it's kind of like, and then Martin Short comes along and he's like the main part in the second half of the film. It's like, it's fucking bonkers, right? And then he did like Cheaper by the Dozen, mm-hmm. which is kind of like a meritless movie. But it's what's sort of weird about it is the fact that it's based on a true story. So there's a lot of kind of like plot and setup in the first 10 minutes. So it feels slightly jarring because they're trying to sort of like go, well, this is the actual story. And then we're going to do like the family sitcom thing that we've got planned. So Cheap by the Dozen 2 actually works out a little bit better because it just hits the ground running. And then Eugene Levy turns up in it as his rival dad. Oh, it's just like, there are funny moments in all of the films, and Bonnie Hunt is really good. So there's funny moments in both of the films, but they're so lightweight that it's just kind of... And so when you go back and watch Planes, Trains and Automobiles, it's like, yeah, it's funny, but Steve Martin and John Candy, but Steve Martin is putting in a genuine performance. Like, he is... He's not just the straight man, because he is very funny in it, but... He has some real dramatic stuff to deal with, and he's sort of like he's bringing kind of like his A game to it. And when you watch something like Cheap by the Dozen, which was made like 15 years later, it's like Steve Martin going, "Yeah, I know how to be a dad on camera. I'll do it." Like, yeah,
it did seem like a shame. It felt a bit like these are his films where he's just buying his art collection. With it's just, and I don't know, and it was always that whenever he had a hand in the writing, they were always good movies. It always just felt like they were always good movies, and it just felt he was almost turning up in the kind of early 2000s for things and just being, you know, like I can do comedy and just being, you know, this sort of comedy actor in these films that felt very either lightweight or, in the case of something like Bringing Down the House, absolutely appalling, absolutely yeah. like. Extraordinarily appalling films.
Mm. And the Pink Panthers as well.
Of course, yeah. Bilko's.
Bilko was, yeah, misguided. But then once he's done Bilko, why would you go and do Pink Panther? Why would you? If you, you know, anyway. And then, yeah, I think Bowfinger was his last great film.
Obviously, it's sort of frustrating a bit because he's obviously still so funny. And you see him like on Twitter and he, you know, he's naturally... super funny all the time, and it almost makes you think, well, do that.
when he hosts the Oscars and stuff like that, he's great.
Yeah,
which he hasn't done in 20 years maybe, but like when he did it, he was brilliant. I love him, but yeah, it's sort of troubling. But like, so I watched a YouTube video this week, can't remember the channel, but if you Google Planes, Trains and Automobiles original cut, it'll come up. The original cut of Planes, Trains and Automobiles was three and a half hours long.
Yowza.
And then they cut it down to 2 hours, or maybe 2.5 hours, and then the final version is like 90 minutes. So they cut it and they cut it and they cut it. They've cut out...
a whole other movie's worth of...
Yeah. But there is an original cut of none of the deleted scenes have ever been. I think there's maybe one deleted scene on the plane, and then apart from that, none of it's been made available. So there's a 3.5 hour cut of Planes, Trains and Automobiles out there that I think sounds fascinating. And you know what the YouTube video is saying, it's actually if you watch the film. You can see, because they make references to scenes that aren't in it. So he's like saying, well, you went in my wallet to buy a pizza, and that scene's not in it. But you kind of like imagine that they've spent enough time with each other that that's something that's happened. And there's a scene near the end where John Candy turns up with a black eye. And he sort of says something like, he gets out of the front of like a huge truck. And he goes, oh, the guy's a bit funny about riding up front with him. And he's got a black eye. So you can kind of assume that the guy hit him in the face. But in actual fact, it's a scene that's been completely taken out. And Michael McKean is like almost at the end of the film, he's almost top billing. And he plays a cop in one scene. And Michael McKean has said, you know, that they filmed like a lot more. There were like all these plot details that didn't come out. So I think we should start a petition to get the original cut of...
release the Planes, Trains and Automobiles. Release the used cut.
Yeah, that's what the guy says on the YouTube clip. He says we should all sign a petition to do it. I'd love to see that. Because John Candy, as great as he was, He only made like a handful of classics.
Oh.
You know, and they were all in quick succession of each other. If you look at something like Summer Resort? Is that what it's called?
I don't know what you mean.
He made a summer film where he takes his family away, which isn't very good. And then he kind of made... he's in the background of a lot of films. You know, he's in Vacation.
He's a kind of co-star of Brewster's Millions.
Summer Rental, it's called. He's in Brewster's Millions, which wasn't a great film. Planes, Trains and Automobiles was the one that really sort of like cemented him. He was in Splash. He was great in Splash. But Planes, Trains and Automobiles really cemented him with John Hughes, and then they just wanted to work together. Great Outdoors, not a great film. John Hughes, when he was making Planes, Trains and Automobiles, basically he was down to direct The Great Outdoors. Which was John Candy and Dan Aykroyd. But then he'd also got Planes, Trains and Automobiles on the go. And so he swapped because he wanted to work with Steve Martin. Which, if you're Dan Aykroyd... Yikes! All right, we've got to do fan mail now.
Oh, well, yeah, of course.
That hour has gone by... fast.
Quickly.
Well, for us... who gives a fuck what it sounds like?
This is what we do anyway.
This is pretty much what we do anyway. Have you seen anything of any note this week?
Not that needs talking about.
I think that we've got an opportunity with our guest today to actually do what the show should be.
Yes, I do.
So maybe we should do that. Anyway, Brian's here, so let's do some fan mail.
I love fan. Hey, boys, by the way, it's nice to be here. I'm looking forward to Christmas.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you on the Zoom, Matt. Right, here we go. Nathaniel, Nate. Now, right, okay, off we go. Let me put on the reading glasses and off we go with the fan mail. I love fan club. Dear Nick and Nathaniel, Metcalf.
Also to Brian Johnson and Christopher Lee.
Oh, that's very nice of you to acknowledge me. I hope this finds you well. I've been a listener, me and Chris. I hope this finds you well. Well, I've been a listener from the beginning. I thought it was about time I wrote. I'm currently rewatching Ash vs. the Evil Dead on Netflix. It's a fantastic series. I wondered if either of you had seen Happy, also on Netflix. Oh, sorry. I wonder if you had seen Happy.
Also on Netflix.
Fucking hell, man. And if so, what your thoughts on it are? I'm a fan. It's the thing I always suggest if anyone asks for recommendations. Ah, found me voice. In all the years you've been making fan club, I don't remember you ever discussing the work of Kevin Smith in any depth. Do you rate him as a filmmaker? Any favourites? He'd make a great guest one day, perhaps. Kind regards, Andy Collin.
Interesting. That's a big one.
I'd say I've not watched the series. It came out as a comic book first, and I remember reading the first issue of the comic, and I didn't really take to it, so I'd never watched the series. But you're not the first person who's mentioned it, so maybe I'll give it a go.
I watched the first episode of the series a couple of years ago, and I didn't really like it, so I didn't persist. But, you know, it has been recommended a lot, and I think that you can't really judge something by the first episode or the first series, you know. Sometimes stuff that gets cancelled after the first series should have really got a second series so that they could have seen it develop. Kevin Smith, I watched the James Hunt Bob reboot this week.
I went for a stage where I don't know that I like his movies, or I've ever really liked his movies as much as a lot of people do of my age and my generation. But what I kind of increasingly he started popping up on things, and I find him quite a likeable personality more and more when I hear him chatting about stuff he likes.
I like him. I have watched 3 of his Batman commentaries online, where he basically just chats his way through Tim Burton's Batman, Tim Burton's but it's Batman. I think I've watched Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, and then I watched Batman. I haven't watched Batman Returns, but they're funny commentaries that he does. And I really like Clerks, but when he didn't kind of like evolve as a filmmaker, I think Clerks is an amazing film. The fact that he got it made, I really like the way it looks. I really like how sort of like not sloppy, but like homemade it is. I like. It feels very much like El Mariachi in that sort of respect. That it's a filmmaker that's making a film for the first time because he wants to, you know. And then when he didn't really evolve as a filmmaker, I kind of like was a bit. I think I stuck with him for a long time. I didn't like the. Anyway, Jay and Silent Bob reboot is it's there for the people that love him. And that's all I'll say, really. Because this is fan club.
Neither can that! How are you doing? I'm a bit of a Grinch and I feel I need to get into the Christmas spirit. Do you have any Christmas film suggestions for me? Cheers, Holly.
Ah, with a name like Holly, I would imagine you would have been a fan of Christmas. Well, I would say instantly something like It's a Wonderful Life. I would say the film I was recommending.
And then it just felt like it felt mean. It's all right, that.
I would say. What else? Like, there's tons of good Christmas movies.
I mean, Planes, Trains and Automobiles is a Thanksgiving film, but it's basically watch it at Christmas. It's brilliant. What would I watch at Christmas? Do you know what? I'm really looking forward to watching just a bunch of horror films and Martin Scorsese films.
Well, do you know what? Weirdly, last Boxing Day, when I was at my mum and dad's house, I watched The Irishman. For 3 hours when I should have been spending time with them. And now, weirdly, when it's coming round again to Christmas, I think I've associated with Christmas so hard in my mind from last year that I almost feel like I might watch The Irishman again.
Yeah, I think I did the same thing. Well, I didn't do the same thing. I watched it just at the beginning of the new year, but I really loved it. And that's what I think of Christmas, is kind of like... Christmas is a time of year where, all the way through the rest of the year, I feel really guilty if I watch a film and I've got stuff to do. And Christmas is the time of year where you can literally just watch the stuff that you actually watch. I might watch Obsession with the Brian De Palma film, because I just loved that. And I think I watched that last Christmas. So. But I don't really... I think Christmas films are so sort of... generally shit that it's kind of like... Why do that to yourself?
Well, I guess it's a good opportunity to watch whatever you want to watch.
I will be watching National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation on Christmas Day in the morning because it's tradition. Right, really quickly. Hey guys, what's up? My
noughties and Netflix. It's just released a documentary about Maradona. Sometimes Netflix is weird, timing is really creepy. What do you think? Thanks.
Yeah, sometimes the timing is creepy. Yeah, absolutely, you're right. You're bang right there. And
hello, how's it going? Oh, all is well. I have some cool information that might interest you. You are very rank. You are very rank, Malta. Your podcast, Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fat Club, has good performance in some rankings. Position 33 in the category comedy, Malta. Position 159 in the category comedy, Ireland. Position 170 in the category comedy, Estonia. Cool. Happy podcasting, Carlos.
Thanks, Carlos.
Hello.
Oh, sorry, I...
33 in the category comedy.
Malta.
Position 159 in the category comedy.
Ireland.
Position 170 in the category comedy.
Estonia.
Cool.
Right, okay, brilliant. We're going to play a song and then we'll get our guest on. We'll be right back.
year's been a busy blur. Don't think I have the energy. Red am I already mad much? Just cause it's just the season. The perfect gift for me would be completions and connections left from last year. Ski shop encounter, most interesting. Had his number but never the time. Most of 81 pass along those lines. So deck those halls, trim those trees, raise up cups on Christmas here. I just need to catch my breath. Christmas by myself this year. Down the picture, frozen landscape, chill this room for 24 days. Evergreen, sparkling snow, get this winter over with. Flashback to springtime, some again. Would have been good to go for lunch. Couldn't agree, we're both free. We tried, we said we'd keep in touch. Didn't, of course, till summertime. Out to the beach to his boat, could I tell him no? This time it was me, sunburn in the third degree. Now the calendar's just one page, of course I am excited. Tonight's the night I've set my mind, I've been dreaming too much about it.
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! We're back! We're back live in the studio. We're not in the studio, or live. We're pre-recording on a Wednesday. And I'm in my living room, and Nat is in his washroom. And we're joined in the studio now by comedian, writer... I'm not going to fucking bother. I'm not going to do that. So we're joined now by Matthew Crosby.
Hello. How you doing, guys?
Very well. I'm very well. Thank you for asking.
It's my pleasure.
How are you, Nat?
I'm very well, yeah. And how are you, Matthew?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
Where are you joining us? Is that a living room? You've got a sofa?
This is the living room. I keep the sofa here. Tends to be the best place for it. It's pointing at the telly. I've just moved into a new house, so I don't have curtains, but I do have a sofa. But everything takes a long time when you move into a new house, and that's the situation I'm in at the moment. So, like, there's nothing on the wall behind me. It's looking pretty bare. It's looking pretty sparse. I mean, I've been put to shame by the absolute Storage Wars display that Nick Helm's got going on behind him.
Yes. because there comes a point in your life where your possessions own you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I kind of regret a lot of my purchases, but that's fine.
That happens when you move in house as well, where I'm terrible. Like I should get rid of stuff and I can't. And one night my wife went out and basically sort of put a load of boxes in front of me and said, right, every time we've moved, we've brought these boxes. They're unopened. There's nothing in them you need. Get rid of them. And I managed to whittle 7 boxes down to 1 box. And even the stuff I kept was just crap. It's just like the thing is, it's all like I found like notes to like call comedy clubs when I first started, doing stand up. I was like, well, I can't throw that away. That's the first time I called the Chuckle Club and they said no. And then the Chuckle Club closed and I never played the Chuckle Club. I've got to keep that. I don't know why I want to keep these mementos of things that didn't even fucking happen.
I'm exactly the same. I'm too nostalgic for things. When I see it, like in a closed box, it'd be a lot easier if I just threw a box in a skip. With attitude, like, I don't need any of this stuff. Never thought about it. But when you open it and you see what's in it, it's like, oh, it's this. I love this. But it's never anything you need.
Yeah.
I feel like it's my responsibility to document the entire comedy scene through my life. So it's kind of like I'll open a box and I'll find flyers for stuff that I saw in, like, 1997.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the what you gain from that is you have like fond memories of stuff that you probably wouldn't have thought about without the visual aid.
What it means is once every 5 years, I take a photograph of something and text it to the person who's on that flyer. That's basically it. I'm sort of doing them a little favour, you know.
Maybe you just took a photo of all of your stuff and then you could get rid of it.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Just if I just live an entirely digitized life,
yeah.
It's a good idea. You know, it is a good idea. I'm always like I always think about is it Michael Landy? Is that the name of the guy who shredded all his possessions as he did it as a worker as an artwork? He's the guy who's married to Gillian Waring. But I think about that a lot because I think basically you don't really my partner and I have my child and I have my family. I don't really need all this stuff I'm hanging on to. Maybe I should just shred it all.
Yeah.
Just shred my entire life.
Not your family though.
No. I mean, those are the things I keep. Sure. He didn't shred his... part of the artwork, he didn't shred his family. He shredded all his possessions.
I can't work out whether I missed a bit or... Yeah, fine. Okay.
When I was saying I've got these things, these are the things that are important. I shouldn't have made that clearer. I've got my family. They're important. All my possessions are the things I want to show. Imagine if I'd started the interview by going, so I've got this child now. She's been around for about 16 months. I just want to stick her in a shredder.
Yeah, but if you took a photo of her...
Exactly. I've got to...
get rid.
Yeah, exactly. Photograph the kid, pop them in a wood chipper. Do a Fargo on them.
Fuck. Sure. All right. Okay.
I sort of imagine it's like you've got this sort of archive of stuff, almost as if we're going to get a call from one of the big universities saying, listen, we need to have, we've got like Stanley Kubrick's boxes. If you haven't got any of your shit about, and it's like, yeah, I'll do you a favour. I'll offload all my shit onto you.
Well, you say that, Nat. You say that, but there is a comedy archive at my old university, the University of Kent. Oh, yeah. And genuinely, Dr. Oliver Double, he was there when I was at university, so I wasn't on any of his courses, but I was such a saddo, I went to his lectures.
His name is Oliver Double?
Yeah, Oliver Double, yeah.
Like a pun?
It is like a pun, but it's his real name.
Sure.
His real name is Oliver Double. He calls himself Ollie to sort of soften the pun slightly.
Sure.
I mean, unless you're a skateboarder, I guess. Is there such a thing as an Ollie double in skateboarding? Presumably there is. But anyway, he calls himself a Dr. Ollie Double. And he was there when I was at university, still there. He's head of drama, but he also runs an archive. I think it started when he got all of Linda Smith's archive. So again, you know, a real comedy talent. But every now and then I'm chucking out old props from Pappy's shows. And I just say to him, do you want this? And that's kind of, there's an enormous big Pappy sign from our show in 2009 that's in my parents' shed. And when I get the chance, I'm putting it in the car and driving it to Canterbury because he wants that as well. What he's going to do with it?
Do you think he does want it? Or do you reckon it's one of those things, if you ring up, he can't say, do you want this? Massive sign.
But you know what? There is that, because my dad calls me and says, do you want it? And the answer is no. But rather than saying to my dad, no, chuck it away, I go, well, I don't want it, but maybe Ollie will want it. I bet you he's got someone just down the line that he's passing it on to. It's like Swap Shop. All the way. Yeah, I don't think anybody actually wants it. And eventually it's going to end up on your doorstep because you're just too polite to say no to the person down the chain.
Well, that did happen. I did a preview with you in Polperro.
Yes, brilliant. Those are two fantastic days for Ian Rigby.
It was. They were great gigs. But you left behind a stick that was about 8 feet long. And I got a text saying, oh, we've left our stick behind. Is there any way you can get it back to us? And I went, sure. And I didn't think anything of it until, like, I was trying to take an 8 foot long pole on a train. Yeah. And it is like a sort of, it's like the film The Plank. You can't actually go anywhere. And it's this sort of massively long thing, which is like tearing the ceiling of the train. And it's kind of this awful thing and just embarrassing thing that you're smashing into people, with people looking at you going, why has this bloke got a massive stick? It's only when I handed it back to you that I thought, I mean, could you not get another stick?
Yeah, I, do you know what? What will have happened there is, in a blind panic, we'll have gone, that's our special stick. That's the stick we use for the show, and not thought about, you know, I'm sure Nat will be able to bring it home. Like, yeah, everything's replaceable. Everything, you know, no prop we've ever made or bought or whatever has been so brilliantly constructed that we couldn't knock it together in 35 seconds. Especially a stick, which I imagine, if it was as long as you're saying. And I remember the stick, we use it for Tom to play a scarecrow. That's too long. Doesn't want to be that long.
It doesn't.
Wants to be about an arm span. What's that, about 2 meters?
Yeah. Your arm span is the same as your height.
No. Oh, is it? Is that why the picture of the guy with the arms sticking out in the circle, is that?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he wasn't crucified in a circle, was he?
Well, I don't know. It must have been a bit of a crowd.
the Leonardo da Vinci picture of a man standing.
Yeah. What's that called?
I wanted to say, and it's, what is it called, Nat? Do you know it?
What's it called?
It's called something like, well, in fact, I'm saying something like, as if I know.
What's it
I
called?
Don't know what the next thing I'm going to say it's like. Is it? I want to say something, the something man, isn't it? The something.
Yeah. I wanted to say that.
It's called the. Bicentennial Man, or something like that.
Yeah, it's Lawnmower Man.
Oh, it's Patch Adams, that's the one.
Like Patch Adams. They used to bring that round the hospitals and cheer up the kids. But yeah, that's it. He's sticking his arms out, but it's also, it all fits into the...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't just make it up. It's your height. It's actually an 8 foot pole. Tom Parry's quite tall, isn't he?
Yeah, so he's not 8 foot though, is he? He's 6'2".
But if he's a scarecrow, a foot either side, that's not that much.
Natalie sent us the title of it. It's The Vitruvian Man.
Man, that's right. But the thing is, what you could have done...
It's right, Natalie.
Rather than stick a pole, you could have just had a foot of dowel rod out of each of his sleeves and he could have just put his arms out.
I'm not going to lie to you. He's a strong actor. He could mime that pole. I reckon. He's a good performer. You put your arms out as a scarecrow, people are going to believe you.
Sure.
He was wearing a straw hat. He had his arms out. I think we get it.
The stick, well, I guess that's part of it.
The stick wasn't the challenge for the audience to picture that.
No.
I guess part of the thing with Pappy's, though, is the idea that sticking something in your coat or whatever it was, it looks uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's partly what the fun is, right?
Yeah.
Laughing at someone.
It looks uncomfortable. It probably takes him a little bit too long to get to the stage, so he's running onto the stage with it still shimmying it down. All of that kind of shambolic stuff. That was what people enjoyed, yeah.
What was the show called in 2009? Was that Funergy?
The 2009 show was Pappy's Presents 200 Sketches in an Hour.
No, I didn't see that.
No. Okay. It was good. It was a good show. Final Jewish 2008. Do you see that one?
Last show ever.
Last show ever was 2012. That was the one that had the scarecrow in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the first two were just called Pappy's Fun Club. I mean, basically, what we did is we made it very confusing for people to... Because Pappy's Fun Club already, quite a confusing name. Pappy's quite a confusing name. We were always adding extra stuff, you know. Pappy's Fun Club, Funergy. Just call your show Pappy's Fun Club. That's all you need. But anyway, yeah. I wonder what happened to that stick. Probably ended up under my house and then got thrown away.
Probably in some sort of museum, I imagine, knowing you.
Yep, probably in the archives.
Have you ever been invited back to do a speech at your university?
We got invited back to do a Q&A, which is worse. Because at least a speech, you can kind of control... You can control the narrative. You can say, here are all the things I've done. Goodbye. Whereas, you know, a Q&A where you come out, and this was, we were performing at the university that night. So we were doing the Gulbenkian Theatre that night. And so the Q&A was before any of these students had seen us perform. So like they didn't know, they had no questions for us. I mean, like Ollie got all the people on his drama comedy course to come along and chat to us. But like, when most of it is them going, who are you? Who are you is a really bad first question for a Q&A.
If that was an audience with Kenneth Williams, it'd be awkward, wouldn't it? Mr. Williams, have you got a question? Who are you?
I did a Q&A with Oliver Refson, which isn't a pun.
No.
Who wrote and directed Uncle. And that was awkward because no one gives a shit about actors. So I'm sat next to the writer and director. Everyone wants to know, how do you write it? How do you direct it? How do you do all this? And I'm just sat with him.
Yeah.
And so often you feel like you've got to chip in just because you're there. But fuck me.
Yeah, no one needs to know how you remembered all the words. How do you know which way to face? Well, he tells me. He's the director.
He'd have asked me that, though. That would have been quite a lot of... it would have been very exposing.
Yeah.
Before that, you would turn up anyway to these Oliver Double lectures on comedy.
Because you
were a comedy fan, right? Before you got into it, you were kind of... Was it everything you wanted to do?
I think basically, once I saw Vic Reeves' Big Night Out, I sort of thought, yeah, I think that would be the dream. I mean, I think the thing I liked about Vic Reeves' Big Night Out is that I think up to that point, I'd wanted to be a pop star. And he was kind of both. He'd come out at the start, like he was obviously sort of a parody of a light entertainment performer, but he would come out at the start and sing a song by Jesus Jones for no reason. And not in a particularly funny way either, just because he thought it was quite cool, you know, wearing a Savile Row suit and with kick flares and stuff. He'd sing that and they'd do a load of absolute nonsense for half an hour and then he'd sing a song at the end. I thought he's kind of cracked the dream job, really. And that's kind of not a million miles away from what Pappy's ended up being, which was us coming out, singing a song, doing a load of silly stuff, singing a song at the end and leaving. It was kind of... So, yeah. But, yeah, really, I think from the age of about 10 onwards, 10 or 11, that was it. That was the dream.
And was Pappy's... Did that start at university? Or was that... Was there at one point... What was the kind of origin of that? And what was the origin of you being a solo stand-up? Or was it all happening at the same time?
Sort of. We used to do like very long, big kind of gigs at the old coffee house in Beak Street. And there was, when we first started, it was, we just hire that room for 25 quid and hope we'd make the money back on the door. And it tended to be people we knew most people in the audience, even though we always stuck it in time out, but no, like there was never a stranger in the audience. And we do one a month and we do maybe like 2.5 hours. And it must have been a fucking nightmare for people to watch. But they were very kind to us because they kept showing up. Like literally, like I would have been 23, 24 and my mum and dad were coming along to watch it, which I think is, now I think about it, mad. What must they have been thinking? You know, they must have been so disappointed.
It seems very nice to me.
It's very sweet. Yeah, it's very sweet, but it's only one step away from performing a show in the living room after Christmas. Only this time, you've, like, it's the only change really is I'm charging them a fiver.
So was that the beginning of it? You were just like, let's put these shows on.
Let's put long shows on. Let's call it Pappy's Fun Club. Let's do, we all did stand up and there was like seven or eight of us when we first started. And slowly but surely we whittled it down to four and then a little bit more abruptly whittled it down to three.
Right. But you were solo stand up then. So it wasn't
We were all doing stand up.
On a show.
No, we were all doing stand ups that would. It would flow into sketches. I'd just seen Mr. Show for the first time. And so every sketch, no sketch had an ending, basically. You know, so every sketch ran into the next sketch, which would run into us ending up on stage doing sort of stand-up kind of solo bits and bobs. And that was kind of... And it was like always based around a theme and always based around the idea of this mysterious benefactor. Basically... Very complicated. We were really into doing very complicated, like unnecessarily complicated stuff.
Yeah, I like that, but I know what you mean. I'm a fan of overly complicated things, but I know, I understand that is not the right way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was our last show we did, last show ever, that we realised we don't need to have five or six moments in the show where the show's in trouble because Pappy said something. Like, Pappy was this kind of mysterious benefactor who no one ever saw, but was always sending us, like, he sort of forced us to do these shows up in Edinburgh, and we sort of didn't really know how to do the show, and it would always be falling apart. And you go, you don't need to say all of that. Just do a show and have it fall apart because you're incompetent, and the audiences will get it. But it took us... So when did we do our first show? 2000, yeah, so it took us 8 years to realise that, of just constantly doing this thing that only made us laugh and it didn't really, and confused more people than it entertained. And then eventually we went, oh, yeah, we don't need that bit. We'll drop that bit.
The old coffee house years, or year, when would that have been?
2004, 2005, yeah, maybe like 2004, 2006. So, yeah, we probably did about sort of maybe 15 or 16 shows over the course of 2 years.
And is that what was the material you were writing there? Was that condensed into your first hour show?
Yeah. So really our first show was the kind of the best 45 of about 317 hours of comedy. Yeah. We'd done loads of stuff. And in fact, actually, I remember after our second show, we got taken out for dinner in that exciting way that used to happen in Edinburgh, where like someone from the BBC would see you and take you out for a dinner that the BBC would pay for. And I remember Brendan saying, like, and this is in all seriousness, like saying, well, we've probably got about 14 hours of material. And obviously we didn't. We'd been on stage for 14 hours doing different things, but that's not the same as having 14 hours worth of material. We barely had an hour, but yeah, we believed it.
And when you were doing stand up at the same time, so around 2004.
Yeah. Yeah. Started doing stand up on the circuit. That sort of went okay. And then if people said, do you want to come back and do another gig? I'd say yes. Kind of bring my three mates and we'll do that. And that seemed to just, yeah, that seemed to move a bit faster than the stand up kind of ever did.
Oh, that's interesting. So you were kind of, that was what you wanted to do more than doing solo stand-up.
I think I just preferred being, yeah, I mean, I loved doing stuff on my own, but I like being with, I just like performing with other people.
I mean, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, weren't we? Mm. And I suppose you've got to be a bit more disciplined when you're working with other people as well.
Yeah, it forces you to do it because you're all, you know, you've got to write as well. I think one of the things I really didn't do enough of when I was first starting out stand-up was right, just actually physically go, right, I'm going to sit down and work out all the funny things about this thing I want to talk about. What's the funniest turn of phrase to use for this? What are the angles I haven't explored? I would normally have half an idea, write two things down on a bit of paper and go up on stage and hope there was a fair wind behind me and I could improvise, you know, these amazing routines. And it almost never worked. Occasionally you'd come up with one or two funny things that would stick, but most of it was just... complete and total waffle. But if you've got a process, is it?
Yeah.
But like stuff like songs and stuff, you sit down and you write those songs.
I make them up on the spot. That's what I do. That's my magic.
You just make the whole... Well, it, yeah. You know, for some people it works. For other people...
Just turn around to the band. I say, watch me for the changes, and then fuck it out.
This is in G.
2 hours later, standing O's, mate. Standing O's. No, but sometimes songs work like that. Sometimes songs work like, I've got an idea for a song, and then you sort of like make it up. Not in front of an audience. But yeah, I agree with you. I wish that I'd had sort of like more discipline earlier on. The thing is, I got rewarded for standing up on stage and making stuff up off the top of my head based on three notes quite early on. And when you get rewarded for stuff early on, why would you bother going back and working?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, I wasn't even getting particularly rewarded. I just enjoyed it so much, I didn't give a fuck. And that was a bad attitude to have. Like, I kind of wish now, if I could kind of do a cut and shut of my personalities, I wish I had my current work ethic with the fearlessness I felt at 24. Yeah. You know, when I could go on stage and go, it doesn't matter if this doesn't go great. Like, now... I just feel, I mean, partly because I don't gig as often as I used to, even before the lockdown. But now I just go on stage. I'm so nervous that it's going to go badly. And I don't remember feeling that at all.
Which is weird though, right? Because you've put the work in.
Exactly. So I should be, by rights, I'm better now than I was when I was 24.
But I think when I started, I was the... going up, and I think because it was also terrifying for me when I started, it would almost make no difference if I would go up and go. And also the idea of thinking, oh, I'm gigging for someone who's seen, not the audience, there would be like someone who was on who had seen me before, so I'd go, right, well, I better write a whole new because it will look ridiculous if I'm doing the same thing and this one comedian who I've gigged with once before will have seen any of it. So you'd almost be like, because it was such a terrifying thing to do at the start, what you're actually doing was more risky. I wasn't
totally. Anything.
It was like my attitude was almost, I'm going to do this thing which is terrifying tonight, so let's make it even more terrifying and write a whole new 5 minutes.
But then I think there's a safety net to going, here's a brand new thing, because you go, well, of course it wasn't going to work. Hmm. It was brand new. Whereas, you know, I don't know why it's sort of... It's hard dying when it's like sort of hard dying with old material.
I wouldn't necessarily say, of course, it wasn't going to work, but I think that because it's new, because you've just thought of it, then any reaction is a positive.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know what I mean? It's not that, oh, it's okay that I died on my ass because I was trying something new. Oh my God, I got 5 laughs out of 20 minutes. That's amazing. I just made it up.
Yeah.
Well, I wish I had that bravery now. I find whenever I have to try and write something new now, I just can't get into the zone of having that bravery of just going up with absolutely nothing. I have like backup plans and like, well, if I do this, I'm going to go into an old bit of material.
Also, my writing voice is entirely different from my speaking voice. So I spent 8 years writing theatre before I did stand-up.
Yeah.
And what I realised from that was that you would write... and the theatre was really kind of more like sketches, or it was sort of like monologues and stand-up. But because it was written and learned, if something didn't work, you'd stick with it for a month in Edinburgh because that's what you'd written and rehearsed.
Yeah.
Whereas as a stand-up, you can write something and it not work and you go, fucking hell, I'm going to change that. But as soon as it's sort of like written down in theatre, then it's kind of like, it's not stand-up anymore. I don't know. I think you're freer to sort of like move around and swap stuff.
Although actually one thing, we certainly did a lot of writing as Pappies, but what we didn't do was rewriting.
Yeah.
So once we got a show up to Edinburgh, and again, that only started happening in later shows. When we got a show up to Edinburgh, there'd be bits where we're like, you know, there was one bit where we were going, the joke was we were going through the mailbag and it was all these kind of basically like hate mail that people had written to us. But obviously as well, all written to Pappy, who was then relaying them again, you know, that extra layer that doesn't need to be there. All written to Pappy, it was relaying the message to us. And every every letter ended with, by the way, that meat you sold me, are you sure it was lamb? Right? Every letter ended with the same phrase. And never got a laugh. Made us laugh so much when we were rehearsing it. Never got a laugh. But we never thought, oh, we should probably, you know, we've done this now 5 times. We should probably just stop doing that bit or change, or, you know, even if you're not going to write a better line. I mean, a better line wasn't even, it's not even a joke. It doesn't make any sense. Even if you're not going to write something else, at least take that line out. So you're not having a thing, which is clearly, because we would giggle as we read it each time. Sometimes we wouldn't be able to get through the sketch. We were finding the idea of that meat you sold me, are you sure it was lamb? So funny that we wouldn't be able to get through it. And the audience just sitting there going, what are we missing out on that you find so funny? And the truth is, even now, I couldn't tell you. I've got no idea what we thought was that. I don't, you know, was he selling, like, was it offal, or was he selling human meat, or was it sort of, you know, roadkill, or it doesn't make any sense, but we kept it in, you know, every single, we must have done the show 25 times.
I reckon the audience must have been thinking, this will be coming back later.
Yes, exactly.
I get it. Okay, just wait till the end and there's going to be a big...
We'll get around to it.
...ending or something. It's huge. It's
weird. Someone's going to come and dress as a sheep, yeah.
It's weird, you know. Like but that happens in stand-up as well, doesn't it? Where kind of like you'll be doing Edinburgh and there'll be a line that maybe doesn't work in your show. And then you get to the end, the rest of the show's great. And you get to the end, you get like a round of applause and you leave and you're like, oh, great. Don't have to think about that till the next day. And then he'll be on stage and then he'll go, it's that line that's absolutely fucking terrible that's coming up. It's about 10 minutes away. And I know I've got to say it because I haven't rewritten it. And then you'll get to the end of the show, you'll get a round of applause. You go, oh, thank God, I don't have to think about that until tomorrow. And it'll happen for like maybe 2 weeks in a row until you go, I'm going to cut it. I'm going to cut that line today. You'll say it to your technician as you're setting up the set. You go, you know what? I'm going to cut that line today, Aaron. And then he'll go, good, good. It's got nothing, mate.
Because I have to deal with it as more than you do. You know, I have to hear you say it and get nothing.
It's true, though. That'll be the only time you think about it. It'll be like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. This piece of shit that I have to fix.
Yeah. I remember going into the Brooks Bar in, this would have been, again, maybe 2008, and running into Ellis James. And he had his headphones in and he was listening back to the show he'd just done and making notes. And I thought, are you mad? Why are you doing that? You've just done it. Go and have a drink. Enjoy yourself. Like, yeah. But I remember thinking that was absolutely insane. And then, of course, you know, he went on to have a really good run in Edinburgh because he'd spent a lot of time working on his actual comedy. And we just had this mentality that, like, I think that's also comes down to the fearlessness that, like, we thought we were right. And I think that's part of what's gone away. And rightly so, is the idea that I know what comedy is and the audiences are thickos. In fact, the opposite is true.
I had a whole song in my 2013 show that never worked, but I had a video for it. And so I was like every day I'd be like, oh no, the song's coming up. And then you'd have to do a song where I was wearing a leotard and I was like prancing around the fucking stage, selling the fuck out of it.
Yeah.
And literally to the whole audience, it was really loud. The music was loud, so you couldn't hear whether they were laughing or not, but you could see their fucking stone-cold faces for 5.5 minutes as you prance around doing this song. And it was like every day, you couldn't change it, you know? And then when I did a London run, I just swapped something that I did on one of the other songs with that song. And then you go, oh, I did it on a treadmill instead, which I did with another song. But the song that I did on the treadmill was strong enough to not do it on a treadmill. And the one that I didn't do on a treadmill didn't work. So I just sort of like, it wasn't a treadmill, it was a cross trainer. But yeah, it was just like swapping it. You go, right, I don't have to rewrite it. I'll just distract them while I'm doing it.
Just more props, isn't it? Just throw more props at it. What you really needed, Nick, was an 8-foot-long stick. That's what that needed.
Well, that was the thing. I left my cross trainer behind at a venue and I said, Nat, can you... Nat was halfway back to London before he realised, can I get a cross trainer from London? It was
But he actually travelled back on the cross trainer, didn't he? He just started powering it and it shot off down the motorway.
Yeah. I put it on some train tracks and I started trying to make my way back.
I remember running into you after that. You were thin as a stick. You looked amazing.
Well, up top, but his legs. We're going to do something that we've never done before.
Okay.
I think we're going to ask you what you're a fan of.
What? Yeah. Are you telling me that our conversation has run so dry you have to go into the emergency part of things to the producer before the show?
I don't think this is an emergency part. This is what the fucking show is meant to be.
I know. It is the fan club, isn't it?
We've never done it.
Have you never done it before? Surely you've...
We sort of do occasionally do it, and then the show ended up becoming... We just ended up starting chatting to people, and then it gets to the end.
We don't need to explain this on air.
No.
Right?
No.
It says here that you're a fan of Caddyshack.
Love Caddyshack, yeah.
Why? What about Caddyshack do you like about? What is it?
Well, I think it's the fact that it seems like, it seems quite cobbled together from a load of disparate parts. And it kind of is, really. It's like all of the bits don't seem to really, and also that they'll do anything for a laugh. Like there's so many bits that are just, For no reason at all. There's a bit where Judge Swales has to turn, like swing round in his chair to talk to a character. He swings round his chair. You hear a knocking sound. He goes cross-eyed, like he's clearly hit himself in the balls or something, right? And then the scene carries on. And I think that is a commitment to stupidity that I really, really enjoy, right? You don't see any, like, and also the fact that, like, I like that things, when things are like a human cartoon, like no one in real life goes cross-eyed when they get hit in the balls, apart from Rick Mail in Bottom, or, you know, someone in Caddyshack. And I like those moments when you go, well, yeah, of course, that's funny. I remember not wishing to sort of bring it back to me again, but when the guys from Cowards, the sketch team Cowards, very cool sketch team, Tim Key and Tom Basden and Stefan and Lloyd. I remember Stefan, they came to Pappy's one year. Stefan came up to me afterwards. And we were a bit nervous because they did comedy in a very stripped down way. They were like no funny voices. We always just talk in our own voices, no costumes. It's like a complete antithesis to what we do. And I remember Stefan coming up to me afterwards and going, I don't see people doing comedy that way. Like there was a bit where, you know, I had to run on as I was the world's smallest ever woman, but some radioactive gunk had flown on me and I became a normal sized person. But of course, I was still wearing a little skirt, so I had my ass hanging out. And he was like, I like the fact you think, oh, I can get a really big laugh just by showing these people my ass. And I was like, of course. Why would you not get your ass out on stage to get a big laugh? And he's like, oh, we just don't sort of think of comedy in those terms of like, oh, maybe we could end a sketch by someone getting their ass out. We just don't think like that. And I think that's the kind of comedy I like, where it's, you know, it's dumb and it's dopey. But it just really makes me laugh.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I guess, but the idea of something being cobbled together like that could make you think you've done it wrong. But I guess you're right. It is just throwing everything at it.
But that film was kind of like, it was about the kids that worked at the golf club.
Yes.
And then they got Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Rodney Dangerfield all on board. And then it became about them.
Yeah,
I don't love that film, but I do love bits from it. But I think what I don't love about it is the fact that you're basically having to go through this tedious plot of these guys, of the caddies.
Yes.
Rodney Dangerfield is on, you just go, this guy's amazing.
I get that, yeah. There's some... It's not the actual plot of it isn't great, doesn't hold up. But I like the fact that there's... I think if it was all nonsense, it would be... It's almost like, yeah, it's almost like people have just decided to talk over a sort of a 6 out of 10 movie. They were, you know, it could have just been like a teen sex comedy, except they've got a bunch of old dudes to come in and talk over the top of it and make it a million times better. I think that's what I like about it. It feels like the film's been... It's like Hell's a Poppin' or something. It feels like a film has been ambushed,
yeah.
You know? And I think that's...
Hijacked. It's actually hijacked by a better film.
Exactly, yeah. It's hijacked by funny people to come in and, you know, just... I mean, and I think loads of it was improvised.
But that is actually what happened. It did get hijacked by a group of other people.
And that's...
Who were all incredibly competitive with each other.
Oh, I can believe it. And also from, I think, all doing a ton of drugs as well.
Yeah.
They were all like, and it kind of smacks of that a little bit. It smacks of like, there's almost no filter on it, basically. They haven't decided to go, right, maybe we should cut this bit out. They've just done a load more coke and gone, yeah, we'll leave this bit in.
Have you seen, is it a pointless and futile...
Yeah, the David Wayne movie with Martin Mull. Yeah.
What's it called?
Is it A Stupid and Futile Gesture? Is it called that?
It's something like that.
Yeah.
That is one of those films where you think, oh, I might give that a miss. And then when you watch it, you realise it's pretty good.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. Well, I like David Wayne a lot. I think he's a really interesting guy. He made Wet Hot American Summer. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Which is, again, another one of those movies where it's like, what dumb stuff can we do?
Yeah.
You know, again, it's a kind of parody of a summer camp movie, but it is a summer camp movie that's kind of been hijacked by some really weird
Does
stuff.
That go against what you were saying before about, you know, you were talking about the right thing is to give the audience what they want, which is correct, but there is something idiosyncratic, right, that you have to bring to it yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 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 I don't think, you know, if the former were the case, then the biggest comedians in the world would be the best comedians in the world. Hmm. And that's not always the case, Well, I'm very close to Kevin Hart, so I don't want to slag him off on the pod. That's all right. I don't think you can make Caddyshack. Yeah, you know, like I think it's a happy accident.
Yeah,
I don't think you could
Have you seen Caddyshack 2?
I have, and what a disappointment! Because it is basically like, let's just do the same movie again, but we've got Jackie Mason instead of Rodney Dangerfield.
And Dan
who else? Dan Aykroyd instead.
Oh, yeah.
It's bad. It's really bad. But it could, you know, like. Caddyshack 1 could so easily have been Caddyshack 2.
But I think we talked about this a little bit before, but like I think you get that with comedy sequels where I think Anchorman 2 is basically it's kind of like it's a film that's made around everyone's schedules.
Yes, yeah.
They all turned up. Oh, well, I saw Father of the Bride 2 the other week, this week.
Yeah.
And the fact that they get all of the main cast back is kind of like, including the kids and the parents of the son, it's kind of like the fact that they get. It's kind of like really rare that they all turned up for the filming of that film. Whereas when you watch, like later series of Arrested Development and stuff, when they're
it's mad, isn't it? And they can't get everyone together.
They can't get everyone in the same room.
And it's really, really hard to watch. I mean, that's the same. Anchorman 2 is the same thing of like, let's do a big fight scene, but clearly they've managed to get every single person for 35 minutes to stand in front of a green screen.
Yeah.
How does Father of the Bride 2 stand up?
I mean, I think maybe one of the biggest disasters for comedy sequels. And also it comes back to like right when you're writing another show for Edinburgh as well, it's knowing what works and then kind of like relying on that. So
yeah.
Martin Short is maybe in two scenes in the first Father of the Bride and then he dominates for the last 45 minutes of the second film.
Right.
And everyone loves Franck. He goes, we like Franck in maybe tiny, tiny doses where you go away still liking everyone else in the film. And it's kind of like with Anchorman. It's kind of like, well, everyone liked Brick, so we'll give him second billing. He's got a romantic subplot. It's like Brick, a three-dimensional character. Coming in and out, but
I've forgotten about that. Yeah, he's going out with Kristen Wiig, isn't he, in Anchorman 2? Oh man,
everyone liked the fight, so we'll do a really big fight with huge celebrities. But like you say, everyone's on green screen because they weren't all available.
I think this is the way a lot of these American comedy movies have always been. They're kind of often quite thrown together. And often, whether it's good or not, just seems to be whatever alchemy happens to be in the room or not. And sometimes it's just like, well, that doesn't work. But there's often no discernible thing that's better or worse about it.
I think as well, Caddyshack at the time was a massive flop. I think it's since taken on a kind of cult status.
Well, it's one of those series of films that they made, didn't they? They made Animal House, which was Animal House in a cottage, because it's Animal House.
Yeah.
And then they made Caddyshack, which was Animal House on a golf course. And then they made Stripes, which was Animal House in the army.
Yeah.
So they kind of made National Lampoon's Vacation, which is Animal House, only in a family. You know, it's kind of... And then you had like Porky's and stuff like that. They kind of like went the way of the slasher films where there was one big hit and then everyone started making kind of Meatballs. That's Animal House on a summer camp, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all the same thing. But I think, weirdly, Animal House probably, probably. Animal House is a better movie than Caddyshack, but it doesn't, and I love it, but it doesn't quite get me in the same way. There's something about Caddyshack that just feels like, I can't believe they've got away. Everything, like even how crap the gopher looks.
Yeah.
You know, like the gopher being like so clearly like a sort of toy robotic puppet type thing. It's just, it looks, I mean, it would be so much better if you couldn't see it. And I don't know why they didn't do that. Or like Rodney Dangerfield dancing to Journey.
Yeah.
As if, like, to show how cool he is. It's just, like, there's so many bits that actually... I don't know if I'm actually laughing with them in that instance, but it makes me laugh so much. It gets me, in a way. Every bit of it makes me laugh.
And what I would say, for a film that I don't particularly like loads, I do spend a lot of time thinking about Caddyshack.
Yeah.
And I like more than films that I love. Like, maybe I saw Planes, Trains and Automobiles, but I don't quote it. But with Caddyshack...
It's very, very quotable.
I just always think about that scene with the hat. And he goes, that's a terrible hat. What a disgusting hat. That's the ugliest hat I've ever seen. Hey, looks good on you.
Looks good on you, though. But when you get that, you get a free bowl of soup. Boy. And he does a really good kind of like... to the, like he's doing, basically, he does it to the camera as well.
Yeah.
And he's, actually, now, thinking about that as well, his Japanese friend, that scene doesn't hold up too well. But you know, like... It was very much of its time. It's full of really dumb jokes, and I like that. And again, that's Rodney Dangerfield being Rodney Dangerfield. Like some of the most I don't know if you ever watched the old appearances of Rodney on Carson, which was basically just Johnny Carson saying, "So how's your week been?" And he just does a bunch of jokes about all these things that have been happening to him and how he doesn't get any respect. And I love it. I just think and that's kind of what they've done here, is they go, okay, go into the golf shop, talk about some of the stuff, you know.
Those Johnny Carson appearances, he would do 10 minutes of stand-up or 5 minutes of stand-up.
Yeah.
And then he would sit down on the sofa and then he would literally just do another 5 minutes of stand-up where he was just being fed kind of like subjects.
Absolutely. With Johnny just slapping the desk and falling off his chair. It was great. I mean, he's... and again, he was like another, like my experience of Roddy Dangerfield, I knew Back to School, which is, I remember being liking a lot as a kid, but I think it's because it was a bit rude, but I don't think that's a film that necessarily holds up. But then I've since found out he was like, he went quite sort of mad in his old age. He was a big cokehead, ran his club, Rodney's, and he would never get dressed. He wouldn't ever really put clothes on. He'd wear a dressing gown, but nothing else really. And so he would MC his gig sort of basically naked with his balls hanging out. So he'd be MCing the gig, you know, be doing all his stuff, but in like a silk robe. And then he would go off backstage and do a load of cocaine and then come back on, like again, with his robe undone, and his balls hanging out, and MC. It was like, imagine if you'd been a big Caddyshack fan and you saw, oh, Dangerfield has opened up down the road. We should go and see Rodney Dangerfield doing comedy. I bet he's really funny. Or you'd seen him on Carson in the 70s. And then you went and saw him in like 1994 and he was there coked out of his mind with his nutsack out. It would just blow your mind.
I think I'd love it.
And there's no ifs or buts about it. I'd enjoy it.
But there's also Robin Williams does an impression of him in Aladdin. And
yeah.
Then they're playing chess, and he goes, I can't believe it, I'm losing to a rug. And his eyes go all spirally, and he looks exactly like Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah, fucking hell, it's a Rodney Dangerfield impression in like a kid's film. It's kind of, it's great. We've got 5 minutes left.
I was going to ask you a question. You've got a lot of, you're quite good with trivia, aren't you, Nat? You know this. I mean, actually, you both are. Do you know if this is true that the Aladdin script was ineligible for a best screenplay because of the amount
of improvisation? Yeah,
is that? Yeah, I thought that might be the case. Yeah, because he just made so much of it up.
Yeah, he made. Yeah, it was. Yeah, they. Yeah, the other thing was that they promised not to use him on any of the advertising, and of course, when they made it. They went genie heavy with the advertising, and so Robin Williams fell out with Disney, and that's why he didn't do Return of Jafar, the second one. And Dan Castellaneta did it. Homer Simpson did the genie voice in the sequel, and then I think they paid him off with Picasso, which lured him back to do the third one, which was. So he doesn't do the he does the first and the third one, but he doesn't do the middle one because they broke contract with him.
Why would it's quite a weird stipulation to put in your contract? I will do your movie, just don't put. Arguably, I'm going to be in your movie and I'm going to beef up my part, so I'm the main guy, right? I know the movie's called Aladdin, but I'm going to talk so much that I'm going to make the part a bigger part than it already is, but don't put me on the poster. It's a weird time to get shy, isn't it?
Don't put me in any of the adverts. Don't use me in any of the McDonald's promotions. Don't do anything. It's just like, what the fuck are you thinking?
Why would that be the... I mean, you know...
Why do it?
Exactly. Why, you know, like, it doesn't make any sense that he wouldn't want to be used. Of course, Will Smith, not at all shy. Yeah, the first image you saw was big blue Will Smith looking ridiculous.
But that's why that film doesn't work. Was because the original film was made up of 300 hours of Robin Williams on cocaine pulling stuff out of his ass. And then they script that, and then they go, go on, Will, you do it. And then he's just basically got to do this. That's crazy. You're coming with me! Right, okay, just really quickly, Matt. What is Caro Diario?
Oh yeah, that's by the way, that's my sort of, if people ask me what my favourite movie is, it's my sort of pretentious choice to put down. It's an Italian movie, but it's also again a film that I think is hilariously funny. It's a film by a filmmaker called Nanni Moretti, and it's basically his diary entries for a year, and it's just him driving around on his moped. It's like, it is pretentious because it's an Italian movie about a man driving around in a moped talking to himself. But it's also really, really funny.
Okay.
Is that all the time we have for that?
That's all we've got. Because we've got 1 minute to play Better or Worse now. So come on.
Okay, here we go.
1 minute. It's called Better or Worse. And you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion.
Okay, here we go.
Too slow, Nat.
Is Wes Anderson better than Wesley Snipes?
Worse. He's worse.
He's better. Ian Anderson, better or worse than Wes Anderson?
Better.
Worse. Oh. Pamela Anderson, better or worse than Gillian Anderson?
Better.
Worse.
Worse. Oh, Pamela Stevenson, better or worse than Pamela Anderson?
Better.
Better. James Van Der Beek, better or worse than Pamela Stevenson?
Worse.
Worse. James Spader, better or worse than James Van Der Beek?
Better.
Better. James McAvoy, better or worse than James Spader?
Worse.
Worse. Rupert Everett, better or worse than James McAvoy?
Better.
Better. Rupert Murdoch, better or worse than Rupert Everett?
Worse, far worse.
Worse. Rupert Grint, better or worse than Rupert Murdoch?
Better. It's close, but he's better.
Better.
What's that? Eight. He's got an eight. That's unbelievable. So you scored an eight, which means that you're not as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manfred, Joseph Daney with 10, David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, but you are as good as Susie Dent, Charles Esten, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacs, Simon West, Magical Bone, Samantha Morton, Matt Okine, Miranda Raisin, Griff Rhys-Jones, Chris Stark, Stu Whiffen with 8, and you're better than James King, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, and Kevin Delaney with 6. Matthew Crosby, welcome to the clubhouse. Thank you very much for being here today. It was lovely and delightful to talk to you. Don't go away. We need to talk to you after we finish recording. But for now, goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from...
And goodbye from me.
Everyone take care, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.